I'm pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse, Professor Martin Drunn. Good morning, Martin.
It's fantastic to be here, Michael.
Well, I can only think of one place where it would be better to be, and that would be at a Matildas World Cup football match. There are, if you stop and think about it for 2 seconds, Martin, not only these magnificent sporting events in Australia and New Zealand, but there's Test cricket, there's Wimbledon tennis, there's golf happening here and there. And of course, there used to be, or maybe still is, the Commonwealth Games. But bread and circuses wasn't only the stuff of Roman emperors, Martin, but Dan Andrews seems to have perhaps copped a bit of egg on his face over the Commonwealth Games. What do you think about it?
Oh, look, he should have some egg on his face, because whilst in theory you can cancel a project that's not very feasible, it's their own figures that led them to take up the Commonwealth Games in the first place. So really what they're admitting is that they've got it all wrong. That's the only way to actually read between the lines. Their due diligence wasn't nearly thorough enough. The other thing is there's lots of mixed messages coming out about actually what happened. And if you speak to the Commonwealth Games people, they'll say, well, the figures he's quoting are nothing like what we've seen. And also that there wasn't appropriate dialogue before he cancelled this. He's just sort of shoved it on them. So, yeah, I think it was quite disturbing that you would agree to do this and then just pull the pin because it's a bit expensive.
Well, it's plain from everything one reads, you would assume it's the case that there were contractual obligations and there's breach of contract and the Victorian government can have to pay out. Presumably they've made a quick assessment on the back of an envelope about how much they'll have to pay out, and is it significantly less than running on with the games?
No, I think that's the only way to interpret it, is that they're well and truly aware that they're in for a payout, but it's still better than going ahead. And I imagine, see, that this particular Commonwealth Games has a big emphasis on regional venues in Victoria. So those regional towns will be bitterly disappointed, I imagine.
It struck me at the time as not a bad idea for the Commonwealth Games to do something different. The alternative is, and maybe this is what is going to happen, it'll die. I mean, what is the significance of a Commonwealth Games these days? There's constant world athletic championships happening here and there. Everyone's getting ready for the Olympics. And on top of it all, as Kieran Pender wrote in a very good article in The Guardian during the week, you've got this huge backdrop of British colonialism and imperialism hanging over the Commonwealth Games. Perhaps it is time to let it quietly slip into the sea.
Yeah, I've seen a little bit of... I think there'll still be people that are sad, probably a bit, especially older people, who remember quite a few iterations of the Commonwealth Games. They've been around since 1930. So they've got their own legacy, which is significant. Arguably, that's not the same legacy these days than it was in the past. But there's still plenty of people's special memories of the Commonwealth Games. That would be also, can I say, probably a real death knell for the Commonwealth to some degree, because can you name any other significant Commonwealth events other than the Commonwealth Games? You know, what else does the Commonwealth actually do other than have a Games every 4 years?
Martin, that is a very good question. I have to say, going back to your comment about people having a soft spot, every time I drive anywhere near Bolg Park in Perth, the 1962 Commonwealth and Empire Games comes back to mind. The Games Village became a housing village in City Beach for those who could afford it. And there is still that soft spot, only superseded perhaps by John Glenn, the astronaut, telling everybody around the world that he could see Perth's lights shining bright.
That's right.
That was always the reason for people taking these games on. It meant they became better known. It was a tourist thing, perhaps. Hmm. But can we segue without any very clever segueing point to robo-debt? It looks like we're starting to see the fallout. There are a number of articles in the media over the last 24 hours saying that senior Department of Defence official Catherine Campbell has been suspended, not just suspended, but without pay in the wake of Commissioner Catherine Holmes's report into robo-debt. She was the the top official who seemed to have admitted that what went to cabinet was misleading. This may not surprise anybody, but let me ask, did it surprise you to read that?
It surprised me a little bit she's suspended without pay, because I'm not saying it's unjustified. I'm just saying that normally in the public service, it's rare to be suspended like that. Public service is a very bureaucratic place, and so they normally go through a whole range of process before they get to that. But it does probably outline the seriousness of the allegations. And the sense that someone needs to be accountable for it. And certainly Catherine Campbell has been the number one name in the spotlight around this. And her evidence at public hearings for the Royal Commission into Robodebt was particularly disturbing in so many ways. And a lot of commentators have commented on it. It does, did she have empathy for the people who are victims of Robodebt? She had very curt responses. She's very dismissive about a range of things. That didn't, endear her to a lot of people. I do hope and expect that there are a variety of people that face issues of accountability for what is one of the worst instances of maladministration we've seen in a long, long time. So I think she's only one of a number of different names in that broader mix.
It's certainly going to cause all of the public policy courses in universities and halls of greater learning around the country to reflect on that ethos of public servants, particularly senior ones, giving frank and fearless advice. That really is at the root of this Robodebt, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And I know that these are only allegations as such, and for her to face any criminal sanctions, she would have the right to defend those allegations. But I would there's a clear indication in the report that they would be prosecuting people. So that's what the public would expect, where charges can be brought against people involved in this, that indeed happens.
It's an interesting question. My quick assessment of what's happened with the commissioner's report is that there's a range of sanctions that are available, just like there are from Corruption Commission recommendations. It doesn't always lead to a corrupt criminal finding, but it can lead to pretty sloppy decision making and failure to attend to the responsibilities. It can lead to disciplinary sanctions. If you're an employee, including a public servant, you can suddenly find yourself hauled before the Public Service Board and asked to answer questions, and you might be sacked from your job. And I suppose that's what's really at stake for someone like her in this case. I mean, another instance that seems to have just popped up in this general area of what we'll put in inverted commas corruption is a report overnight, once again, that the WA Triple C has been looking into something that the State Housing Authority did, which the Commissioner John McKechnie said was highly unusual. They got mixed up in a joint venture, or at least they should have been, in relation to land development down at Success in the southern parts of Perth metropolitan area. But instead, they went and bought shares in a private company, and the investment was a disaster. And the commissioner said it was the antithesis of good governance. They think it might have cost the state $30 million. Without going into the sort of commercial details of it all, you wonder, as a broad principle, after WA Inc. In particular, why a government department would be going in and buying shares in a private company and, in that sense, speculating like any private land developer. Are you shocked like I am, Martin?
I was shocked by the report. I certainly haven't read this in detail, but as reported in the media, it does sound really disturbing that you would be investing in a private company like this. It's quite astonishing, and that's exactly what can happen when you invest in a private company. You can lose money because, in effect, you're speculating. So I was really surprised by that.
Well, sometimes these findings of corruption commissions can reflect on the politicians, the ministers who are notionally under our inherited British system of government, responsible for the actions of the people in their department, in their agencies. John Kerry's just, I think, come into the job, and he's as appalled as the rest of us are, it seems. But I'm starting to wonder whether we're seeing a trend towards the apolitical politician being pre-selected in the future, whether the non-political independent seemingly is going to be the candidate of choice in the future, the Teal type candidate. And I noticed that the Liberal Party's launched a Teal style search, as it's been called, beyond their own membership, in a bid to find someone who could possibly oust the very popular Sydney MP Zali Steggall from the Warringah seat that it's been held by the Liberals previously forever. What do you make of this? Is there a trend?
I think it's actually a smart move, although I can understand why it's going to upset some people in the Liberal Party. But what they've had the last couple of times, both in terms of Tony Abbott and then Catherine Deese, in the last two times that they run, the views that they were espousing were not commensurate with the people, broader people in that electorate. Now, I know Tony Abbott had been a member of Parliament for that area for a long period of time, but by the time of the last iteration, that what he was saying and what Zali Steggall was saying were completely different, and people went with Zali Steggall. And Catherine Deves did no better, in fact, worse, with the things that she was espousing. You've got to meet the views of your electorate. So if the electorate of Warringah is well-heeled, maybe conservative in economics and things like that, but fairly progressive in many respects, not all, but in many respects socially. So you've got to try and find the right candidates. And that's why the Teals deal well in those electorates, because what they were saying and who they represented was a bit closer to the broader bulk of people there. So if they're going to launch this Teal-style search beyond their own membership, that's not necessarily a bad thing if they don't have the right calibre candidates. Having said that, they'll upset a few of their own members. If I've lived in the seat of Warringah for a long period of time and I've been a Liberal member and served my time, probably not that excited by that idea.
You think, though, it might start to set a trend for all political parties to go looking for good candidates? I don't think that's a novel proposition. People have been cherry-picked before, but do you think it's something that might happen more widely?
It could increase, especially in certain types of electorates. As you say, it's not new. People get headhunted to serve in seats across the board. It's really, really a common thing. And you get lots of stories about people who are party members for 2 nanoseconds before they're pre-selected.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's not new. But I think, it's balancing that with party members who also feel that they've put a lot of time and effort in the party. And frankly, a lot of people who do that are hoping to stand as candidates. So you've got to try and balance that. I think that clearly there's a bit of an indication then in the New South Wales Liberal Party they need a few more Teal-style candidates amongst their own members.
We sensibly avoided predicting the outcome in the Fadden by-election in the Gold Coast last week, only because it was pretty clear to everybody, even Blind Freddie, that there was not going to be a change in political allegiances there. What was the ultimate result? Were there any surprises for the political scientists?
It was a pretty reasonable result for the Liberal Party. They got a swing towards them, which is a massive difference from Aston by-election. It's the average swing towards opposition parties in by-elections is about 2-3%, and that's what they got. So it's an average performance, but it's actually probably not a bad performance given that the Liberal Party brand hadn't been going that well previously. So I think they'll be reassured by that. Also speaks to Labor's problems in Queensland. Labor didn't do very well in Queensland in the last election, did well in a number of other places, particularly in Western Australia. But federal Labor's not doing well there, and this probably just reinforces that.
Martin, we can't finish today without mentioning The Voice. The latest development during this last week has been the putting out of the pamphlets for the yes case and the no case. They're put up and you can find them on the Australian Electoral Commission website. We hasten to add that the AEC hasn't vetted them or fact-checked them or anything like that. They've simply said thank you very much and cut and pasted from the Word document and put it up on the website. And now we're starting to see responses, including here on the Shipping News. And now we're getting the voice feature this morning. I've written a piece asking whether the no case stacks up and concluding that it doesn't. And I hope that'll be helpful for people. Do you think these pamphlets are actually going to make any difference, let alone much difference, in the general course of the debate with social media and newspaper articles and the Shipping News contributing? Is it just another piece of paper when it lands in the letterbox in a few weeks' time that gets dispatched with the other pieces of paper people don't want to read?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to make a massive impact either way, to be honest. There's so much information people either have been getting or will be getting and bombarded with. The broader problem is that most of the things that they're getting is political argument. I think that's not confined to the voice referendum. It's probably just the nature of politics these days, is you're getting one opinion versus another opinion. There's not a lot of facts being disseminated in political debates. And there's a heavy reliance on emotion. And what you also get in political argument is trying to enforce truth in politics is nigh on impossible in many respects. None of this surprises me. But I would probably just emphasize that there's so much other communications going out on this that I'm not sure that's going to be a game breaker either way.
Well, we'll continue to watch the developments in the voice. The Prime Minister said he thought a short sort of campaign period of 5 to 6 weeks would be appropriate. Well, if you calculate that from the middle of the week just gone, then in early September you would have the referendum vote about the time the AFL finals start. But everybody seems to think he's going to calculate that from some later time, which I find a bit odd, and that we'll still have the referendum in the middle of October when the football finals are all over. That's something reasonably traditional, I suppose, in Australian politics. You still think you're getting any different mail?
No, I don't think they're really big changes. Like I said, opinion in politics has always been around. It's just become more polarised, and there's been probably a hollowing out of the centre. The whole problem with the voice discussion is I think it'll be increasingly people yelling at each other. And it'll be less about trying to understand what it means for people and more about why it's a good idea or a bad idea. So that's part of the problem, I think. And I think in the midst of that is people getting a lot of communications, but they're still not always understanding that detail around what it actually means.
That's
a lot of people I speak to say, explain to me what this voice is about. So they're still really unclear.
Well, I am hoping, all false modesty aside, that what I think was a fairly non-emotive piece written by me today might help people to focus on the words and not be as fearful as some of the note people appear to be. But
Some more fact-checking is always a good thing, isn't it?
It won't hurt. Martin, as usual, it's been lovely talking to you. It's been a sort of a funny time in politics this last week or so, but I'm sure the politicians will get back to being politicians before we know it. See you soon.
Thank you, Michael.